7 after 10, our number's 0800 80 10 80. What is your prison? Is a unique personal development approach created by Dr. Paul Wood that helps people identify and break out of their mental prisons. Through his experience in prison, Paul became aware of the fundamental issues that people face when trying to create real change. His subsequent academic study in the fields of human behaviour, development and industrial and organisational psychology led him to establish a way of thinking about who we are as individuals and our capacity to overcome our greatest challenges. And this is known as the Five Steps to Freedom. Paul's academic focus has been on the relationship between people's personalities and attributes and how this knowledge can be used to better understand the complexity of human behaviour. In other words, he's travelling a road that a zillion others have travelled or tried to travel, attempted to travel, over the history of humanity, probably. We will find out shortly how much of an inroad in that road he made. In addition to coaching, Paul has also been published academically and in human resource industry publications. He's also guest lectured at the University of Auckland, University of Canterbury, Massey University in Victoria University, on topics such as emotional intelligence, effective leadership, best practice psychometric use, and professional development. And that quote from Viktor Frankl, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom." Dr. Paul Wood, after the break. Through his experience in prison, Paul became aware of the fundamental issues that people face when trying to create real change. It is the biggest hurdle, I might add, to anybody making change. What's Your Prison is a unique personal development approach created by Dr. Paul Wood that helps people identify and break out of their mental prisons. Paul Wood, good morning.
Good morning.
Let me go back and start, and I don't want to dwell on this, but I want to go back to you when you were 18. You were off the planet.
Yeah.
To summarize it briefly, you were off the planet. You killed your drug dealer.
Yes.
Explain your state of mind. Not when that happened, but yeah, overall at that, yeah, that stage of your life.
Well, I think, like a lot of people, unfortunately, was attempting to deal with circumstances in my personal life that I just really wasn't equipped to deal with in terms of the emotional experience I was having. And as a result of that, I had sought solace in drug use or drug abuse, really. And I was attempting to escape the reality of my situation and not have to deal with it. And that had been something which had been building up over a number of years. There were things such as my mother being terminally ill that I just didn't feel I could deal with.
And she died 3 days before.
Yeah, yeah. So leading up to the events, I was just really attempting to escape reality. I just didn't have the tools to deal with it. And I think part of that was due to the ideas I had around what were and weren't acceptable emotions for a man to have, and the importance of not demonstrating any sort of sadness or vulnerability around it, and really not being skilled in terms of dealing with that. So leading up to the offence, I just started to consume more and more drugs. By the time of the offending, I was just constantly, constantly wasted.
What drugs?
I was consuming, at that stage, morphine mainly. And I was intravenously shooting that up. And I was also smoking weed and basically doing anything else I could get my hands on, anything that would dull my senses and allow me to escape from reality. The unfortunate thing about drug abuse, of course, is that it doesn't just dull the limited or limit itself to the unpleasant emotions, but it also dulls our capacity for happiness and hope and all of those things which really keep us going.
Hope being the most important one of all.
I believe so.
How far did you get in school?
I basically stopped attending regularly as soon as I started college. That was the point when I started associating with a number of people who were engaged in crime and criminal activity, and when I started getting to drugs.
Were you illiterate?
I would say I was pretty close to it. I remember when I first started studying for university, for example, you know, the first paper I wrote was in solitary confinement in prison, where I was for punishment for drug use, which is not something that stopped when I was incarcerated. And I remember printing the whole thing in capital letters in a single block of text because I thought capitals looked neater and I didn't understand what a paragraph or a sentence was. So, yeah, I would say I was limited in terms of my literacy.
So when you started studying in prison, you basically had to go back to school and start from scratch.
Yeah.
How's your spelling now?
pretty dependent on spell check still. I'm not as bad as I used to be, but, yeah, I wouldn't say it's a strength.
So your writing is, once things are corrected, your writing is good?
Yeah, and I would say my understanding of how to structure written information, how to communicate, is vastly superior to what it was. And that's just been a function of experience and the opportunity for feedback and correction over the years.
All right, let me concentrate on this for a moment because we have something in common, and that was your, would love be the wrong word of Viktor Frankl?
No, love would be the right word.
Yeah. So you and I have both read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Mm. What effect did it have on you? What did it contribute?
I think it had a really crucial role to play in terms of my turning my life around. And again, you know, as captured by the title of it.
Did you struggle with it?
Yeah, I think I struggled with that, and I struggled with a lot of the reading I did initially. And in fact, having reread some of the stuff which initially got me started on the ideas that led to my change, and you know, I've certainly understood a lot more of it since my literacy has increased. However, I was fortunate to have the time to persevere. And that was one of the benefits of prison for me, as it meant that I had limited distractions or opportunities which would take me away from really working through some of that more dense stuff, some of that more deep philosophical stuff.
If you hadn't gone to prison, how do you think you might have ended up?
I imagine I would be dead by now. I imagine I would have either overdosed from drugs in my early 20s, or I would have ended up in other situations where I was the victim of violent crime. So, yeah, I don't imagine.
So that was almost 20 years ago, because you're still 37?
Yeah.
Right. And you're 18 when that happened, so it's 19 years. The Paul Wood that exists, the Paul Wood of 18, do you recognise him? You relate to him? Was it you? Is this an out-of-body experience by comparison?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It does feel like a different life and a different person. Yet there were some enduring characteristics which existed then, which I still relate to now. The difference is the way that those demonstrate or manifest themselves in my behaviour. But I think so much of who I really was hidden and masked by all of the drugs I was doing and the false beliefs and ideas that I had that were really driving my behaviour.
You do anything now?
Sorry?
Do you do anything? Do you take anything now? Do you do any drugs, alcohol?
No. I occasionally have a wine, but it's not something of particular interest. I'm pretty keen on my sport and exercise, yeah.
And keeping free?
Yeah, absolutely, keeping free.
Would there be a danger if you indulged in anything that you might fall back, do you think, or have you got control of that?
I don't think I have the same drivers that would lead me into the situations where I would indulge in anything, and certainly not where I would end up in a situation where I'd be abusing drugs or alcohol or anything like that. I just, you know, over the years I've developed the skill set which enables me to be less impacted by the emotions which led to that in the first place. That said, you know, the best choices for me are the choices which don't test that. You know, if I was a recovering alcoholic, and no matter where I am in my journey, I still probably don't want to be going and hanging out in bars. It's just an unnecessary burden on you. Mm. So, yeah, I try to avoid those situations as much as possible.
All right, take us through your time in prison. You served 11 years. How long after you were incarcerated did you start or get the idea that you wanted to make change and effect it?
Yeah. Well, I think it was quite an incremental transition for me. The first thing that really changed was my perception of what education was. Previously, I'd thought education was something that you did to get a job. However, when I was in maximum security in Perimaramu, I started to see education as something that could actually enrich your understanding of the world. And also, I started to read more and more keenly as a form of escapism from my incarceration. And through that started to also change my perception of knowledge. And that prompted me to study. And I still wasn't someone who had the best intentions at that point in terms of my education, or even perceived myself as capable of really studying at tertiary level. I thought it would be useful to study some psychology because prison is a place where it's really valuable to understand what makes people tick. You know, there's a lot of unpredictability in people's behaviour within prison. There's a lot of mental health issues, and it's really close confines. So that was sort of from a self-preservation perspective. I wanted to understand what made people work. However, of course, the unintended consequence of studying psychology is it made me turn that spotlight on myself more than on other people. And as a function of passing the first couple of papers that I had studied, and I had no intention of doing a degree when I enrolled in those. Mm. I thought it would give me some useful insight. And I passed those first two papers, and it really, really blew me away and changed my whole self-concept on what was possible for me. I had been someone who had been held back a year in primary school. I'd been someone who had just no real relationship or sense of belonging in the school system.
Father?
Father, my father was a very quiet man, and someone who is certainly very proud of his children's achievements and my own in terms of education.
But he was there when you were growing up.
He was there.
You didn't grow up without a father.
Yeah, no, he was there. Unfortunately for my father, my mother's illness was the major focus for him, and my behaviour was largely kept hidden from the family. So there was no condoning of my bad behaviour on the part of the family. They were just simply very distracted by my mother's illness.
After the break, I want to come back and just track you through the prison thing. Mm. And more specifically, the education.
Yes.
And then I want to get onto the program and the changes that you made and that you are now helping other people make. News Talk ZB, it is 25 after 10. Now, the story of Dr. Paul Wood. You spent 11 years in prison and you started studying, and we've covered that. Mm. You did a bachelor's and a master's in psychology in prison. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I have to disclose something to you. I think psychology is one of the most overrated and over-abused qualifications that exist. So everyone's doing either media, they want to do media or psychology, and there aren't the jobs there.
Yeah.
And you know what kids are like these days, the young people, should I say, they get out with a piece of paper and they expect to get a job immediately, and then they can't, and you know, there's all sorts of repercussions. You actually had your own ready-made, I'm guessing, use for that qualification. When did you actually get the master's?
I got the master's. First of all, I was studying my undergrad, and I wasn't studying that with any intention to gain employment from it. It was just because I was really interested in psychology. I also majored in philosophy in my undergrad, which was another subject.
So they're all very interesting things to study, but then, again, I say that the jobs aren't necessarily there.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate in that a friend of the family is a guy, Dr. Paul Inglot, who had his own business in consulting and workplace psychology. And he had heard about the changes I was making and the education I was pursuing when he caught up with one of my older brothers. And as a result of that, he came in and saw me and actually gave me a lot of advice and a lot of support in terms of my master's degree and then the first 2 years of my doctorate, which were also completed inside. And he also gave me the opportunity to do work for his organisation upon my initial release. Mm. And it was through that I actually had the opportunity to then build up the capability which enabled me to move on and to start my own business, which is really focused on development.
So this business, which is called
What's Your Prison, is my the business we're talking about today.
Okay, so let me give you a scenario. Let's say you got a 30-year-old. Mm-hmm. He's doing a regular. He's got a regular job. It might be a truck driver, a delivery driver. Mm. Doesn't see much going for the rest of his life. Mm. Takes home a 4-pack every day after work. Smokes a bit of dope as well. Mm. Lives with his parents. Something along those lines. Mm-hmm. You reckon you could do anything for him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of development and change, the first part of that, which is really key, is giving people insight into their situation and also what it is they aspire to be or who they would like to be. And that's something which I think a lot of us don't really spend a whole lot of time on, is consciously considering what our values really are,
But that would be more because you're not forced to confront it.
Mm, indeed.
Whereas you had a reason to confront it.
Yeah, I had no choice. I mean, one of the things about me which has always been consistent is I've always liked to feel that I was justified in my beliefs. And through my education, I actually developed the tools to find out that I was really coming up short when it came to the justifications I'd used previously for my behaviour. And as a result of that, I was confronted with the need to change and reevaluate what I was about, what I believed, and who I wanted to be.
So if you're not actually forced to confront it, nothing's making you, how does the change come? You might ask somebody and they say, oh, yeah, I want to change. I really, I want to change. But there's no driver there.
Yeah. And motivation is key. You know, having the insight into where you're at and the desire to change is one thing, but without a really strong sense of why in terms of what the benefits would be and also in terms of what the repercussions of not changing are, it's really hard to actually prioritise that and to do the hard work that is required. So creating that sense of why for people is a big part of what I do.
Okay, so somebody comes to you because, well, they've heard you today, and they think, I'll go and see what he can do for me.
Uh-huh.
But they come along, what's the process?
The process is really, first of all, to establish where they're at in terms of the desire for change. Because again...
And you can do that easily?
Yeah, it's something which is pretty standard in terms of this type of work. And that's just questioning them and using a different model, which is called the trans-theoretical model of change, if anyone wants to look that up, just to identify whereabouts in the actual change cycle they are. And if it is the right timing, then the process begins in terms of helping them get more insight into what's holding them back, who they would like to be, helping them identify the real motivation for themselves in terms of making that change. And that's when we begin on the how of change, which is another crucial component. You know, you can have all the will in the world in terms of change, but unless you actually have the capability or the understanding of how to start progressing from where you are to where you desire to be, that's going to be a difficult process.
In your business,
mm-hmm.
How many would you have dealt with? How many people?
I think there are different aspects of my business. So in terms of individual coaching, certainly hundreds, but in terms of the actual talking to people about the process and leaving people with ideas, work and speaking to larger audiences, so that would be in the thousands.
Okay, so let's stay with the individuals. Mm. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you, and this will give you time to think, I'm going to ask you if you can anonymously, of course, give us a couple of examples of individuals that you have helped turn around. Dr. Paul Wood, the title of the program, the business, sorry?
What's Your Prison?
Yes, What's Your Prison? The other part of it that was sticking in my brain is the five steps to freedom, which is what?
Well, the first step to freedom is recognizing that we're born free and that the ideas that we develop and the thoughts that we have that hold us back are things which are acquired and solidified over the course of our life. But they're not things which are inherent or that we need to hold on to or treat as reality when they are dysfunctional and they are self-defeating. So that's the first step, is recognizing that those thoughts and those beliefs don't need to control our destiny. They don't need to imprison us.
Second?
The second step is deciding to break free. And that's deciding that you do actually want to engage with change. And again, that's about finding that motivation for change, that hope, that belief that it is in your interest to actually engage in the hard work and make the change. The third step is actually making the escape. And that's where you start implementing the different strategies and behaviours and techniques to, again, start progressing you from where you are to where you want to be. The fourth step is about fighting for your freedom. And that's being a realistic optimist. And that's understanding that there will be challenges and there will be difficulties along the way. That's just a natural part of life and the process. And then the fifth step is about living free. And that's recognizing that real deep and meaningful change isn't something that you achieve, tick off your list of things to do and then walk away from it. It's something which requires ongoing effort. It's something which requires ongoing maintenance.
And therein lies probably the biggest reason for failure for anybody who's making change or wants to make change or succeed or whatever it is they're trying to achieve.
Mm.
That they fall off the wagon.
Yeah, absolutely. And the difficulty is we live in a society where there are so many quick fixes peddled, which just aren't realistic and which set people up for failure. I mean, a classic example would be the book The Secret, which peddles this idea that if you just have positive thoughts about what you want to achieve, it'll happen. The difficulty is that's not consistent with reality. You know, reality involves challenges, it involves finding solutions to obstacles that are encountered. But if you have this idea that things will just run smoothly, then when you do encounter a setback, you tend to blame yourself and give up, rather than using it as an opportunity to further sharpen your tools and build the capacity to deal with those challenges.
So what's your take on positive thinking?
I think positive thinking is important, but realistic positive thinking. Again, you know, there's lots of research which shows that we can increase our well-being in our lives through making use of tools associated with positive thinking. But if positive thinking leads you to a place where you think, you know, you don't need to go and stand under a doorway during an earthquake because you can just think positive thoughts, then it's been taken too far and it could be detrimental.
Yeah. There are various aspects to that approach. Mm. If you think negative thoughts constantly, then your life will undoubtedly be negative.
Absolutely.
But if you think positively, then it's got a much better chance of succeeding.
Mm.
But you can't just think it. You have to actually activate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the positive thinking has to be within the confines of reality. You know, for example, you know, I'm a very keen judo player, and I'm very positive about my ability to progress. But I'm also at an age and at a level of talent where it would not be a good use of my time to be positive about my abilities to get into the Olympics, for example. So again, you know, positive thinking, but within the confines of what's possible.
Alternatively, playing the piano would fall into a different category altogether.
Yeah, absolutely.
As one famous pianist said to me, sitting in that chair, you're never too old, never too late.
No.
When we come back, that example that I asked you for, we'll deal with that. 21 to 11, News Talk Sydney. News Talk to me, it's 19 to 11. Dr. Paul Wood. People are inquiring how they can get in touch with Paul. We shall deal with that before the end of the hour. But I just said to him during the last break, I said, have you still got any bad habits that you haven't shaken? And he said...
I said, I'm absolutely still a work in progress, as are we all. And, you know, one of the things I like to say to clients is that when I'm working with them, it's important that they understand that I'm not some kind of fully sorted human being. I don't really think any of us are. But the difference is that, you know, we're climbing our own mountains. I'm not at the top of my mountain yet, but I'm able to look over and see where they are on their mountain and help identify some of the obstacles and challenges that they might not be able to perceive as clearly from their position. But I still have a long way to go, and it's something I constantly work on.
Give me an example, and it needs to be a good one, obviously, of somebody who has come to you who you have helped.
Okay. So one example that comes straight to mind is of a gentleman in his late 30s, doing quite well professionally, but the rails are starting to come off in terms of his marriage. And also, you know, there are some issues around his promotability as well to the next step of his career. And the reason for this is his inability to deal with his frustrations and those coming out as anger and aggression, both within his personal life and his professional life. Now, his approach at that point, which was dysfunctional, was drinking more and more frequently, more and more heavily. And that would often be a result of the guilt he would experience over these outbursts. Because again, he would recognise that they weren't having a good impact on his life, but he just felt powerless in terms of what to do about it. And I don't think that's an uncommon experience for a lot of us, to have strong emotions that lead us to make poor decisions that we later regret. So in terms of the process with him, the first thing we really worked on was, you know, what are the thoughts and beliefs that he has that are leading him to have these emotions? I mean, one of the things that's key to understand is our expectations of the world are what set us up to have both positive and negative emotional experiences. Mm. Let me give you an example. If I have the expectation that I'm going to be able to get across the Harbour Bridge without encountering a traffic jam during rush hour, then I'm going to be quite upset when I encounter that traffic jam because it's violated my expectation. If, on the other hand, I have exactly the same experience, but this time I expected I would encounter a traffic jam, I still might be a little annoyed by it, but the intensity of the emotion is significantly less. So part of what I do is help people identify, you know, what are those self-defeating beliefs that you have that lead you to have these emotional experiences? So that was part of the first step. Another key important component of that is identifying, well, who is it you aspire to be? Who is it you really want to be? And there are a number of things people can do to start thinking about that. For example, you know, at your retirement party within a professional context, what would you like people to say about you when you leave, when you retire?
That's why I'm not having a party when I retire.
And from a personal perspective, I mean, if you could speak to your future self in 20 years from now, what advice would they give you? Or a slightly more somber example would be, if you could attend your own funeral, what would you most hope that people would say about you? And these types of activities start to get people thinking about who it is they really aspire to be and less caught up in the day-to-day realities of just having to pay the bills and get through work.
So this particular individual came to you and these were the issues that you dealt with. Mm-hmm. And how did it go?
Well, a key motivator for him that we identified was really his desire to be a really good role model for his kids. So he had a couple of kids and that provided the motivation for change. And then once we were able to identify that, we started actually working through, okay, well, what are the scenarios that tend to cause this frustration, that lead to this anger? And we started to understand those with a lot more awareness of what the triggers were in those situations. And then what we're able to do is we're able to give him some tools to be able to actually distance himself a little bit and be less immersed in the thoughts and feelings which led to the negative reactions he was having. And again, I think the idea that you're going to be able to completely change or erase some of the negative thinking that you have or the self-defeating beliefs, or that you're going to not experience unpleasant emotions, I don't think that's realistic at all. So the approach I take is more around being able to manage those in a way where they just don't impact you to the same extent. I mean, the best metaphor I've heard around this relates to quicksand. So if you fall into quicksand, what's the most natural thing for you to do?
You flounder.
Right, you struggle. And then what does that do? It sucks you into the quicksand further. And this is exactly what happens with our emotional experiences, largely because of the ideas that we have acquired growing up around what emotions we should and shouldn't experience. Like quicksand, though, to be less impacted by our emotions, the best thing to actually do is to not struggle with them. When you're in quicksand, because it's a mixture of sand and water, the best thing to do is to increase your surface area, to lay flat and still, and then slowly make your way to the side. Or if you're in a cowboy movie, to whistle to your horse and it will come and pull you out. This is the same with emotions. When we experience unpleasant emotions, you know, we don't like them, we don't want them to happen, but just making space for them and not struggling with them means they'll actually have less impact on us. So a lot of the work I did with this guy was around being able to understand those situations and create that distance and make those space for those emotions.
Is there a result from this?
Yeah, absolutely. The result is that his dysfunctional displays of temper were massively reduced in terms of their intensity, their duration, and their frequency. I mean, the best feedback received there was from his wife, you know, who just was so touched by the change.
Off the back of that, and that fits beautifully with a question I'm going to ask you when we come back about the negatives that might be involved with making progress.
Yeah.
News Talk ZB, it's 9 to 11. Now, before we run out of time, Paul, how do people get in touch with you?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is off my website, which is www.whatsyourprison.com.
Easy to remember, whatsyourprison.com. Mm-hmm. You get anything from overseas?
Yes, I'm doing a bit of work in Australia, and I've recently been contacted as well by the US, and there's the hope I'll be able to get over there and do some work. And also places like Singapore as well and Canada have shown some interest.
Would your conviction, well, you'll have to overcome that.
Yeah, and I have actually been able to travel to Australia based on them not denying my visa. And again, that was quite a process to go through. But it is seen as making a valuable contribution to the country in terms of what I was attempting to do over there.
Good. Now, the question on the downside, the possible negative of making the improvements and the changes that you encourage and help with, you'd be aware of the syndrome of a partner, and for whatever reason, usually seems to be the wife in a relationship. Usually, as far as I understand it, you can get yourself into big trouble here. I want to, after the kids and what, I want to go and find myself,
right.
discover myself, mm-hmm. and off she goes. Men usually go off with another woman. Is there a danger that if you, whether you're a woman or a man, husband or a wife, that if you make the sort of changes that you can help with, that in the end you make those changes, you think, I don't belong here, I don't want to be here with this person any longer, I'm out of here?
Yeah, look, I think that is a realistic consideration. I think that determining who you really are as an authentic individual can often have negative consequences for other people.
That's a good way to put it.
And I do think it's something to be aware of, both in the workplace and outside of the workplace. The decision that actually where I am in life is not a reflection of where I most want to be or where is most meaningful for me can often have those negative consequences for others. And I think that that's an important thing to recognise in the process of change, is that it will be a roller coaster journey of different emotions. It's not going to all be sunshine and happiness. You know, it does involve being able to deal with some of the pain associated with change. And for that reason, a lot of people choose not to break out of their prisons. A lot of people choose to stick with what's familiar and not risk failure and not risk hurting.
Because it could be frightening.
Absolutely. And again, you know, the prison analogy really works here. You know, as terrible as it is, a lot of people who are institutionalised feel more comfortable within the prison environment than they do on the outside.
So let me finish up, and I've only got a minute, but let me finish up with exactly that point. I've got 2 minutes. The comment that, and we hear it all the time, and I'm guilty of it as well, if guilt is the right word. Mm-hmm. Prison's too easy. It's too soft. Mm-hmm. You get treated with luxuries, televisions and heated floors and some, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You say?
I would say that what you'll find is that the bad side of prison has nothing to do with your physical surrounds and what you have access to in terms of televisions and that. You know, whatever your situation in life, small house, big house, you know, you adapt to that, you get used to that. The tough part of prison is the company you keep. I mean, imagine being housed with all of the worst bullies and most annoying people from school, but there's no home time. And then add to that the complete inability to make adult decisions for yourself. I mean, whether you have toilet paper that day, whether you get toothpaste, you know, what time you get unlocked, what time you get locked up, those are decisions which are all taken out of your hands. So that's the tough part of prison. Heated floors, televisions, I don't see that as hugely relevant to the punishment that is prison. Again, those are things you adapt to.
Let me take this final break, then we've got a minute, and here's the question I want you to address. What can be done to help prisoners help themselves that isn't happening now? It is 3:30 to 11, Dr. Paul Wood. Now, in 60 seconds, what can be done to help people who are incarcerated do something for themselves?
I think a really key factor there is creating that motivation for them and not assuming that motivation. I think what we naturally do is we think that because they've done something wrong in the eyes of society, that they should just accept that and use that as motivation for change. Whereas I think what we need to do is focus more on helping them find why for them it is important for them to change. And then being able to help them build that capability. And I do think a lot has been done in corrections since I left, which is a real improvement in that respect. But I still think we lack the political will for corrections to really make those changes.
This is my prescription for prisoners. Mm-hmm. Hard labour from breakfast to lunch. Mm-hmm. Hard labour. Mm-hmm. After lunch, you do your rehabilitation and your exercise and whatever else you might, but plenty of rehabilitation available. And you say in 20 seconds.
Oh, look, I wouldn't disagree with that as an option. You know, I think that the key thing is whatever decisions we make are based on what we hope to get out of it, and they're in line with the research around that. If we want more punishment, fine, but we need to be honest, that's not going to result in rehabilitation or lower reoffending.
Great pleasure talking to you. Thank you.